Hey there, welcome to the Three Creeks Q&A, our weekly podcast that answers your questions about last week's message. Every week in this series, you have a chance to ask questions, and we'll answer them. To submit a question, go to threecreekschurch.com or find us on Instagram and direct message us. To find out more about our church or to give online, visit threecreekschurch.com. And now, here's this week's Three Creeks Q&A.
Welcome back. My name is Joel. I'm here with John Willie Scott the Fourth.
That's right.
By the end of this thing, people are going to be calling you John Willie Scott the Fourth.
John,
is it Willie or William?
It's Willie. W-I-L-L-I-E. Yeah, I get that often. You'd be surprised.
What, people calling you Willie?
Are people just thinking that it's William?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, John Willie Scott the Fourth here with us today. Yeah. Shout out to everybody who asked questions this week. We had more questions than we've had in a long time, so we're answering four of them. Mm-hmm. I'm representing, if you're listening to this and you can't see this, I'm representing the Ohio State University, the Buckeyes.
There you go.
1-0, and nobody's buying me a burrito for wearing this. I'm just wearing it for fun. So
there you go.
This cool. My torso remains for sale. If you're looking for some ad space, something to promote, if you want to promote your essential oils or your shampoo, I'm your guy.
There you go.
You know, like, I'll wear whatever. So just buy me a burrito. We're talking about the kingdom era.
Oh, yeah.
You actually are the one last week who gave the message on the kingdom era.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the questions are pretty good. And I feel like you did a great job breaking down the kingdom era. I think we've gotten to the point in the Bible where people are, they were familiar with maybe creation, Moses, and Joshua,
mm-hmm.
because they watched a movie or something.
For sure.
And now they're into the part where it's like, there's not a lot of movies about Jeroboam and Rehoboam.
Exactly.
So
yeah. Yeah.
People are scratching their heads going, like, I never knew this.
Yeah.
So
it's a fun era, though. Like, it's a lot happening going on.
You were telling
on.
Me maybe your favorite.
I do. Like, if they actually was to take this era and make, I feel like, a movie out of it.
It would be like Game of Thrones.
Yes.
I've never seen Game of Thrones, I think it's like
that will fit. Yeah, we'll see.
Just like backstabbing and corruption.
Yeah.
When I read recently 1st and 2nd Kings, it is amazing to me how many times it says, like, this person did even more evil in the eyes of the Lord than anybody before him. It
yes.
just seems like it gets worse and worse.
It just keeps building on top of each other. Like, no one's learning lessons from the next guy.
Right.
So.
Right. All right, well, let's get into some questions. The first question.
How did the characters in the Old Testament demonstrate what it practically looks like to put your hope in God? What does this look like for a modern Christian?
First, let's define, like, biblical hope.
Okay.
Like, I gave a definition of this, to trust in, wait for, look for, or desire something or someone, or to expect something beneficially in the future.
Okay.
How do the characters in the Old Testament demonstrate this? I mean, with all the, especially here lately in this era and in Judges era, like, you go, is there anybody who did something
right.
that was right in God's eyes instead of their own eyes? And in the Old Testament as a whole, yeah, we've already talked about a couple people. Like, Noah, I think, is a great example of someone who put their hope and trust in God.
Yep.
When you talk about David, the story of David and Goliath, I think that's another great story we see where instead of, like, being fearful like the other Israelites, like, he trusted in the one true God that,
yep.
hey, no, who's this Philistine? We serve the one God, the one true God who's able to deliver
yep.
us.
Yep, yep.
Abraham, you see him with his son Isaac there on the mm-hmm. the mountain going to sacrifice, like, trusting God. I mean, he was waiting for a son for so long, and God says, hey, I want you to go and sacrifice. And he was to the point of doing it.
Right.
And then lastly, I think
And Joseph, he didn't.
He didn't.
For somebody
but
he was curious.
Yes.
But yeah, like, he would have.
He
if
would
God
have.
God had not stopped him. He was totally in.
Totally in. Hope in the Lord. Trust in him 100% yep. is what I would say. And so those are a lot of examples that we see throughout the Old Testament. And there's many more as well. What does it look like for a believer today to put their hope and trust in God?
Yep.
I would say it's an individual who exemplify a characteristic of praying often.
Mm.
I mean, when we pray, I believe, like, it shows a firsthand mindset of, like, Lord, if you don't show up, this is not going to happen. So you're not trusting in something that you can do or
yep.
someone else can do, but you're trusting in something that God can do by going and taking it to him first. So yep. I believe that's a great characteristic. I believe another one would be obedience to God's word, like trusting in his promises, that they're yes and amen, that what it says, that that is what it will be, despite your circumstance or situation. And lastly, I would say praise, like rejoicing in what you have seen God do in your life over the years, like offering up praise, like those three. And there's a whole bunch more, but right. I would just give you those three solid ones.
Three are good.
They're really good as far as like characteristics of someone who's putting their hope in God rather than other things.
Right.
Since the tribe that split from Israel was called Judah, I always thought only Judah split from Israel. What was the other tribe? And is there any significance to why it was these two tribes that split?
Well, to answer this question, you got to go further back. So Jacob has 12 sons.
Yeah.
I don't think I mentioned this in the message. Some people may know it, but some people may not. The first 10 sons that Jacob has are not with, this is going to get me, you're going to have a lot of questions about this, but with his favorite wife. He has two wives, Rachel and Leah, and then has Joseph, his 11th son, and then has Benjamin, his 12th son. So I think I want to highlight that because the hostility between the sons begins at the beginning.
As you can imagine.
Right. There's an intense sibling rivalry. And it's probably not, if I'm guessing, given the human hearts that these people, it's not just everybody versus Joseph or Benjamin. It's Simeon versus Levi versus Dan versus Naphtali. Mm-hmm. It's like, as these guys grew up, there's this, I don't know. They're family, but there's also competition among them. So there's hostility all the way through. As soon as they get their 12 spaces, it's not just them against the Philistines or them against the Amalekites. It's them against each other at times too. So there's this track record of hostility. And then, as you mentioned in your message, you've got a guy named Jeroboam. He's a servant of Solomon.
Right.
A prophet named, I don't know if it's Ahijah or Ahijah or how you pronounce it, A-H-I-J-A-H. He comes along and prophesies that Jeroboam is going to be a king over, and he tears his coat into 12 pieces and gives Jeroboam 10 pieces, 10 tribes.
Right.
Right? This is the prophecy. Well, Jeroboam's afraid of getting killed, so he goes to Egypt until Solomon dies, comes back. And then you already mentioned this, but I'm just recapping.
No, that's good.
Rehoboam, Solomon's son, he's the king, but Jeroboam comes back and he doesn't want to tax the people like Rehoboam does. And so there's this split. And the question is, what two tribes go with the southern kingdom? It's Judah and Benjamin. Well, why isn't it Judahman? It's because Judah is just much bigger, much more prominent, many more people. David's from the tribe of Judah. Like Judah is like a maybe the most noteworthy tribe.
Right.
Benjamin's noteworthy too, though. Saul was from Benjamin. And I believe the best reason I can figure out as to why Benjamin went with Judah was because the capital, Jerusalem, what Benjamin encapsulates, that's where the Benjamites lived. Benjaminites? People from Benjamin.
Right.
Anyways, so they lived in Jerusalem, and that's where Rehoboam would have been reigning from. And so when the tribe of Judah, and which is where Rehoboam would have been from, because David, Solomon, Rehoboam, and Benjamin, they're right there, they're together. It's interesting that the tribe of Simeon, which if you look at a map, the tribe of Simeon, their land is in the middle of Judah. It's like... We don't really have any states or provinces like within another province or state. I don't think, do we?
No.
I'm going back to geometry class.
And I'll probably be the wrong person.
Geography class. I don't know. But if you look at a map, you'll see like, Simeon is landlocked all the way around by Judah. And somehow they even kind of uproot and go to the north and become a part of the northern kingdom. So I don't know if that, I guess, maybe answers the whole thing. Another thing that I found fascinating about that is that, so Jeroboam was worried that all the people from the north would travel down to Jerusalem, which was like, the spiritual city. It's the place to go and worship. It's the place to go celebrate Passover.
Right.
He was worried that they were all going to go down there and then fall in love with Rehoboam, the southern kingdom. This is nice. So he actually built more spiritual cities, if you will, in the north, so that people could go and just stay in their own.
He even built like their own makeshift temple up there, right?
Right.
That wasn't the temple of like what was really established and really built through Solomon, like from God. But it was interesting how he was so in his mind, like, no, I don't want to lose my people down there to the southern kingdom. So let me try to establish.
And, you know, and when I read this too, I'm like, wow, you know, fascinating story, like civil war. And it's like, that's not the only time that's happened. Like, if you look at the track record of Earth, you know, over the last 2,000 years, this kind of stuff's happening a lot. And this is literally a historical account of what happened in Israel, like 1,000 BC almost.
Right.
Or it would have been 1,000 BC. Anyways, so there you go. Yeah. There's why Benjamin went with Judah.
How does Isaiah 26 show the benefits of putting hope and trust in God? It seems like a pretty fearful chapter.
Isaiah is a prophet who goes and speaks in the southern kingdom during the reign of numerous of kings that were there. And his prophecy held the great tension of sharing both warning and judgment, but also like the hope of the future of what's to come.
Okay.
And so as you go throughout the entire book of Isaiah, that's like the overarching like theme or encapsulation of Isaiah sharing with the kings there, like, if you can get your act together, this is what's going to happen. And this is actually, it did happen with the Assyrians. Like, you'll read all that, Assyria coming through, Babylonia rising up. And then it also shares this message of hope of this kingdom, this new Jerusalem that is to be established in that of God's kingdom. In the chapters of chapter 24 through 27 is where we actually, chapter 26 is in that. It's like these series of poems telling the tales of two cities.
Okay.
One city, like a lofty city that is people just exalting themselves. It's not about God. It's just corruption and unjust within that city. It's a pure example of the rebellion of just humanity.
Okay.
And then there's this other city, this new city, New Jerusalem, of God's kingdom over all nations, where there's no more suffering and no more death and crying and tears or whatnot. And so in chapter 26, there's this song of telling the tale of these two cities.
Cool.
Where we see a benefit of hope and trust is, like, it clearly says in verse 3 there that if God will keep those in perfect peace who put their hope and trust in God. And so that's a great benefit that we have, is that even in the midst of chaos, corruption, injustice going on around
us. Sounds like my country.
Right, you know? It's a great promise that we could cling to, we can have hope in and trust in, to know that God would keep us in perfect peace.
Yeah.
And we need to find what peace is, because I feel like a lot of us think we're in a hammock out on the beach sipping our favorite drink, that's peace. But it's like, no, it's this sense of security in the midst of chaos that may be all around you, that you could hold fast to.
Yeah.
But that only comes through those who hope and trust and fix their thoughts in their mind on Christ. And so that's a huge benefit of that we see. This chapter, I would say, it's fearful based off of what side you're on. Like, if you're an individual that's putting your hope and trust in God, that you're fighting to live according to his statue, his word, that you're fighting hard to seek him and walk in his ways, you could read this chapter and rejoice, because it's talking about the kingdom that is to come, even later on, that God's going to come back, establish his kingdom where there's no more there's no more violence, there's no more just unruly or corruption, but there's justice, there's peace, and there's love in this new kingdom that is to come, even for us. Like, and so if that's not the case for you, and I don't say this to like scare anyone into salvation or anything like that, but I'm just telling you the flat out truth. Like, if I'm not following the Lord and I'm just wanting to do my own thing and I read this chapter, I'd be fearful, because there's just this judgment that is to come. I mean, sin has to be judged, and either we could hope and trust, like, and rest in the sacrifice that Jesus has already done for us and taken on that judgment for us, or we will have to give an account for that ourselves if we don't put our hope and trust. And so I believe it becomes fearful only in that context, yeah. But
it reminds me of something I heard somebody say one time. It's like, if you fear God, then you have nothing else to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. But if you don't fear God, there's a lot to be afraid of.
I agree. Yeah.
Especially 100%. The future.
Yeah.
Right? The future ought to be riddled with fear without the security of being able to put your hope and future in somebody else's hands, on somebody else's grace. Like, not, you know, if I'm going to be very fearful if my future depends on my merit or my behavior.
Right.
But if my future is in a God who I believe will fulfill his promises,
I got nothing to be afraid about.
Right.
How do each of the prophets fit into this kingdom era?
So that is a great question. Yeah. And actually, in this upcoming Sunday's message, as I go through the exile era, I'm actually going to maybe break this question down even to some more detail.
Great.
But I will give a sneak preview. Essentially, where do the prophets fit in? There are 17 books that are considered prophecy at the end of your Old Testament. There's three, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, that are considered major prophets. Mm-hmm. And my best guess and what I've read is that the only reason why they're necessarily called major prophets is because they were long-winded and wrote a lot.
Right.
So their books of prophecy are just significantly longer than the other ones. Mm-hmm. So they're considered the major prophets. Where did they write? Wait till this weekend. I'll show you on a map. I think it'll make more sense if you can see it with your seat on a visual. Then you've got Daniel. Daniel is, I would say, half historical, half prophetical, right?
Yep.
So the first half of Daniel is about what happened to Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the exile people, the people that were exiled. And then the second half is prophetic. It's about the future. And then you've also got a book called Lamentations. There is not a person named Lamentations.
Right.
Lamentations was written by Jeremiah. So there's five. I've covered five of the 17. Then you've got the 12 minor prophets. Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Joel, Amos. I could go on. Mm-hmm. But essentially the last 12 books of the Old Testament are considered the minor prophets. And they're really scattered. Like, they're some of them, I think three or four of them are before the kingdom is divided.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, I'm sorry. Well, while the kingdom is divided, but before they're exiled, there's a couple of them that speak like during the exile, and there's a few of them that speak post-exilic or after the exile.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say this too, like, you know, I have to go back, and every time I read one of the minor prophets, I have to go back and read a two-paragraph reminder of like, okay, when was this? Where was this? Why did he write this? If I have the framework of, I know there's a northern kingdom, I know there's a southern kingdom, I know at some point the northern kingdom is captured by the Assyrians. I know at some point the southern kingdom is captured by the Babylonians for 70 years. I know at some point after 70 years, they go back and they re-inherit the promised land. If I know the history, then I can place all those books in context, right? So if I don't know that story, then I have to read Micah and read Amos and read Joel. I love Joel. Great book. I have to read those going like, what?
Right.
Who? Where? If I know this historical timeline of events, I can place their words. Okay, he was speaking to the southern kingdom right before they were captured by the Babylonians. That makes sense.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, yeah.
And that's the fun part when, like, to me, when I learned that, it just, the Old Testament came to life so much of just finding out, okay, this is what's taking place in this time, and this is why, like you said, it makes so much sense when you place.
You can read it that way.
Yes.
Right? So and maybe the, I don't want to say the best part, but for me, maybe the most amazing part of reading the prophetical books, these prophets that were essentially the voice of God at this point in time, when they prophesy, you know, dozens and dozens of things about Jesus, especially Isaiah or Jeremiah, there's a lot of them have a prophecy about the Messiah and Jesus and how he will come and what he will be like. And to watch them all fulfilled 800, 900, 600 years later in the person of Jesus, that is amazing.
It
so is. I would say if anybody's interested in reading the prophetical books. One, you got to read it with the context of who they were writing to and when in the story. And two, keep an eye out for what's considered a messianic prophecy. These guys are going, you know, it's going to be hopeless until
this
the King of Kings, the Prince of Peace, the root of Jesse. Like, I mean, all those kinds of things make the whole Bible come alive. Make it feel like one story and not scattered fables.
For sure. For sure.
So. All right.
Good stuff.
The Kingdom Era in the books. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be back answering your questions about the exile era. So you got to have questions. I hope you ask them. I hope you tune in. And thanks for watching.
Take care, guys.
Thanks for listening. We hope this provided even more clarity as you desire to see God's story, your story, and how they fit together. If you're going through this series alone, you're missing out. We have small groups of people going through this series together, and we'd love for you to join one. To connect with other people, visit 3creekschurch.com to find a community group near you.